everyone, and welcome to Minute 95 of Season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today for the final time this season, hopefully he'll be back next season, when I decide what I'm going to do next season, is Jim O'Kane, the godfather of the Movies by Minute community, the producer of five, almost six Movies by Minute group projects, plus dozens upon dozens of guest shows on the guest spots on lots of other Movies by Minute shows. And obviously, you know, he's done two or three of his own, and there's another one coming out just in February. So welcome back, Jim.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on, Rob. I feel like the Charles Nelson Reilly of Movies by Minutes. I seem to be, every time you turn on, you know, all the different game shows, you'd suddenly pop up with Charles Nelson Reilly on yet another show. So I just kind of a series
regular. Yeah, but he's there as a filler. You're not.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Thank you very
much. You're here to add something to that. And I always love my discussions with you. I've had great discussions with you all week. I mean, I feel like I've been, like, tossing and turning all night waiting to talk to you again. You know? I don't know.
Gosh, it's so close to reality.
Well, of course, because we do these day by day.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Here we
go. Yeah, and it's just minutes apart. It's weird.
It's completely.
It's a time travel without all the machinery.
Yes. It works. Why not?
Yeah, here we are again. So finishing up the week here on Minute 95 with a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff getting set up.
That's right. So Minute 95 begins with John asking a question and ends with John not acting very surprised. So yesterday we ended things with, John seeming to, you know, be very friendly with Bill Clay. And then he starts pulling out a gun from his waistband, which, you know, we were talking about this yesterday. Someone who's never seen this movie, I wonder what they would think at this point. Do they think that he's taking that gun out in order to give it to Bill? Is he taking it out because he suspects something? You know, like you can just imagine someone just pulling a gun out of their belt and just, you know, shooting someone in the head right there. You know, it could be. I mean, obviously we know what's going to happen. We know what John's intentions are here. Because you and I have both seen this movie, as I'm assuming most people who are listening to this have already also.
Yeah, you know, and he's already got the rifle trained on him too, or he's kind of moved it back to like port arms. But it's odd that that's the first thing he offers him.
Yeah,
I would, you know, well, he didn't know the first thing he offered him was a cigarette.
So, cigarette. Yeah, no, but that's the cigarette is to lower the mood, make things nice and fun. You know, maybe try and catch him off guard, you know, that type of thing. I think that is part of the idea of the cigarette. I mean, as I recall when I read from the script yesterday, so the script actually had the point where, you know, he was upset about the fact that he's giving away his last cigarette. It said, you know, that he was, you know, he saw he only had two and he's like, oh, I can't believe I have to give one of these away. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, he's simultaneously, first he's using the cigarette to disarm Bill Clay, and then he's arming him again with a handgun. So it's like disarming and rearming all at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
The question there being ever use a handgun, Bill, is what McClane asked him, and a fascinating answer that Hans comes back with talking about paintball at some kind of a company picnic thing, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's also very interesting the way that he says it. You know, he says, you know how to use a handgun, Bill? And he goes, I spent a week in a combat ranch. You know, the game with a gun that shoots red paint. Probably seems kind of stupid to you. But, I mean, first of all, you know, the idea of spending an entire weekend doing that type of thing, and you probably didn't use a handgun.
You know, there's probably a big Nerf gun, you know, with paint coming out the side, and
exactly,
and everybody dressed up in, you know, motorcycle helmets and stuff. It's again, Hans is telling him this so that it sounds like he is as inoffensive as possible. This is the only thing that this guy knows about is paintball guns, and you know, he's never he's never fired a projectile that wasn't filled with Glidden number 6 paint or whatever to shoot at people. So he's just trying to get, he's still trying to get McClane to be off guard kind of dismissive.
Right. I mean, first of all, I find it once again great how Hans is, you know, answering this on the fly. You know, he's able to make these things up really, really quickly. The idea, if you ever use it, and say, oh, yeah, I used to go play paintball. Now, what do you know about paintball? Let's before we get into the history of paintball and stuff like that, have you ever played paintball?
I have shot – actually, it was at a company picnic a long, long time ago.
Wait, was Hans Gruber there or was Bill Clay there?
No. But a lot of guys that were like Bill Clay. It was at a company picnic. They had a paintball, like a paintball alley thing, and you basically put on these large poncho raincoat thing, which doesn't work at all, by the way, because it stops at about your knees. And I had pants that were covered in green paint for the longest time. I still like those pants, but it was just like, should I just worn shorts that day? it was interesting. I found out I'm very bad at it. I can shoot real firearms. I've used real firearms, but
oh, come on, you're from Texas, of course you do.
Yeah. Oh gosh,
I can see the armory behind you.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Just kidding.
No, you can keep the 12 gauge over the door just in case.
Yeah.
But the
lessons we learned from Western.
Yeah, exactly.
Take down the 12 gauge from on top of the door before you open the door. You know.
Yeah, you never. Yeah, that's the how to answer a door quickly.
Yes.
But it's like the paintball is not like firing any kind of firearms that I've ever felt. It's more like using a nail gun would be about that. It's very percussive. I mean, like, you know, shotguns are percussive, but it's very hard to aim. These large balls, they're about the size, they're not as quite as big as a, they're about half the size of a ping pong ball, I'd say.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've played with a paintball at all.
Yeah, I've done it numerous times. So I'll get to my stories after yours.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But it's I did that at one afternoon as my total of paintball. More of my, the company that I worked with, one of their subsidiaries was a Heckler & Koch. So, there was a lot of opportunities for all kinds of different weapons. They had at the Heckler & Koch headquarters in their basement. They had this long, it was an old cement sewer pipe that was about maybe 4 or 5 feet tall, and they had targets down the back, and they were licensed with automatic weapons. Everything from Uzis to Thompson machine guns and all kinds of stuff. I never got to fire the Uzi, but I did get to fire 3 shots on a Thompson machine gun, and that was an interesting feeling.
Oh wow!
And the MP5s, they had an interesting story with the MP5. The MP5 is a machine gun that is probably best known from the movie Aliens. And if you looked at when the Space Marines were landing and they were shooting their MP5s, they had a little counter that showed how many rounds they had left in the chamber, in the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And that proved so popular. There were several organizations that were purchasing automatic weapons that wanted the counter put on the real MP5.
Oh, wow.
So H&K actually developed a counter, which doesn't make sense because why would you want anybody else to know? I mean, it should be facing the...
How many bullets you have left. You know,
yeah, exactly. So... If you can't count, you know, it's just an interesting sideline of finding out how movies have affected the industry itself.
Wow.
But it's a lot different than a paint gun.
Yes.
So anyway,
it hurts a little more. You know?
Yeah. A bit.
than a paint gun. Right. No. So I,
go ahead.
Back in high school, I remember, going with friends and playing paintball somewhere or whatever. I mean, I once was a counselor in a camp. I think this was in 91, so I must have been 17 at the time. So we had a free day, and me and a group of friends, we all went to go play paintball at like someplace nearby, and we were put up against these these guys from the military who just creamed us. You know, we all got back that night
You were their target practice.
Yes, completely. We had lots and lots of welts from that And I also recall that I once went, a friend of mine, he had a bachelor party where we went in and played it, and we played it in at like midnight, which was a lot more fun. You know,
Wow.
I gotta say laser tag is also more fun than paintball, because laser tag doesn't hurt, you know, when you
Yeah,
get
that's yeah,
hit.
we're in that thing. It's funny, speaking of bachelor parties, my bachelor party, since we're in Texas, my bachelor party was at a shooting range, and I had a lot of my friends from back east had come out to the wedding, and we went down to the shooting range, and they had all kinds of, pistols and long guns and everything, and they had a they had everything from, you could get a Derringer if you wanted to try it out.
Oh, wow.
And one of the my a friend of mine who had passed away, his son I invited to the bachelor party, and his mom, who was also friends with, had come with him. So we had a woman at the bachelor party, but she's the best shot I've ever known. She was hitting we had like a 30-foot range and a 50-foot range, and she was with a pistol hitting the 50-foot range in the in the center,
Wow.
around the center, and her son is just as much a Texas Deadeye as she is. And we one of the things that we had the
I
opportunity
hope
was,
her
they had
husband
the
didn't die under suspicious circumstances.
no,
Okay.
he was of natural causes, but
Okay.
yeah, she's
That's what they
definitely,
say.
I would be very careful knocking on their door at night. But her son got out. He said, "Would you mind if I use the Golden Eagle, which is a 50 caliber pistol,
Wow.
and it fires, half in 50 caliber shots?" And so we all have headphones on, the ear protection, and he gets out the eagle and fires down range, and like everybody else is going click 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 click, and he hits this thing, and it's like a cannon going. I was like,
Wow.
boom! And everybody in the place turned are like, what was that? But he was a little bit off on the first shot, but then the next three he just landed right in the center.
Wow.
And it's like, wow, I'm lucky if I can hit within the area of the paper, I'm happy with it.
Right. No, I've
But
shot a 30 caliber and a 50 caliber machine gun. You know, not a
Oh,
pistol.
wow.
I've never shot. I mean, that was when I was in the military, so it was, you know, during training exercises and stuff like that. No, but I've never, I don't think I've ever seen a handgun that carries a 50 caliber, you know.
Yeah, it's unreal. I mean, the sound of it, and just I fired it once, and it's just it is like holding on to a cannon. I mean, you just it has quite a kick.
Wow.
My wife is from Massachusetts, and never, gosh, she was in her early 50s the first time she had actually held a handgun, and we were down at in Florida at Cape Canaveral, and she said, "I've never fired a gun before." And I said, "Well, let's go to the range. You can try it out." And so she got out a 9mm, and started plinking away, and she just got closer and closer and closer, and finally got the center by, I think she had reloaded once, and it's like, oh, you got the hang of this already.
Wow.
So she's definitely a I always want to stay on her good side.
Yeah, I completely
But
understand. I actually took someone out on a date to a shooting range years and years ago.
wow.
Yeah. She we were talking and
Yeah,
she said she'd never shot a gun, and I was like, "Hey, that's a great idea. Why don't we go to a shooting range?"
there you
You know,
go.
we had like an hour at the shooting
No.
range. They do like a short little instruction and stuff like that. And it was, I mean, obviously things have changed in the last 20 years, that the rules have changed as to how you can go to a shooting range. But back then, yeah.
No, go right ahead. The my wife still I still owe her a trip to a range where she can shoot a long gun. She's never shot a rifle before.
Well, now you know what to get
So,
her. Get her for her birthday.
Yeah, there we go. But she'll put her eye out with those things. So I gotta be careful with
It's
them
not a
because,
BB
yeah,
gun
she.
around Christmas time. Come on.
No. Yeah. So we'll get her down to get her into a long gun sometime. And she also wants. She's never done archery. I said, didn't you ever go to summer camp? What I don't. So anyway, we've got to get her better versed on her weaponry, medieval and otherwise.
Yeah, completely. So back to my original question. What do you know about the history of paintball?
Nothing. Nothing at
When
all.
do you think paintball was invented?
I'm gonna go late. I'm gonna say like 1970.
No, you're not late enough. It was in
Oh, really?
1981. It was
Wow.
invented in New
Okay.
Hampshire by a man named Hayes Knoll, who was a Wall Street stock trader. along with an outdoorsman named Charles Gaines. They basically had a debate as to you know, whether someone whether a city slicker was able to would have the instinct to survive in the woods against the man who had, you know, who had spent his entire life hunting, fishing, building cabins and things like that. So they decided they saw that an advertisement for a paint gun, and they decided that let's settle our argument by you know, making this a competition. And they ended up creating the sport of paintball. By
wow. This. I thought it would have come out of the short story, The Most Dangerous Game.
No. Come on. That's,
yeah.
The Most Dangerous Game, you really want to kill somebody. This is, you know, this is just a friendly argument between two people.
I just want to know, how do they get the paint in the balls? How does that – I'd love to see that process. I would watch a YouTube video of showing, you know, how they get – there must be some kind of an injector, or maybe they have something where you fill up the bottom half and then it puts the top half on. It's just it'd be interesting engineering. I'm sure there's
all right. I'll read you what it says in Wikipedia about that. Okay, the pellets, the ammunition used in paintball are spherical gelatin capsules containing primarily polyethylene glycol or other non-toxic water soluble substances and dye. The quality of paintball is dependent on the brittleness of the ball shell, the roundness of the sphere, and the thickness of the fill. Higher quality balls are almost perfectly spherical, while with a very thin shell to guarantee breaking upon impact, and a thick, brightly colored fill that is difficult to hide or wipe off during the game. The highest grade paintballs incorporate cornstarch and metallic flake into the fill to leave a thick, glittery splat that is very obvious against any background color and hard to wipe off. Almost all paintball in use today are biodegradable. All ingredients used in making of a paintball are food grade quality and are harmless to the participants and the environment. Manufacturers and distributors have been making the effort to move away from the traditional oil-based paints and compressed CO2 gas propellant to a more friendly water-based formula that and compressed air in an effort to become more eco-friendly. Paintballs come in various sizes, including 13 millimeter and 17 millimeter. So there you go. I don't know if that really answers your question, but you know.
Yeah, no. I mean, the two things I've wondered is how do you make the paint pellet, and the other part is, when it hits you, it breaks. You know, it's like throwing an egg at somebody. But how do you make the launcher part not break? You know, like that compressed air or the propane gas that you plug in. How do you keep that from blowing a hole through the back of the pellet? But that must have been quite an engineering feat to come up with something that would accelerate it to the, you know, to the right speed, yet not break it during its max Q.
Yeah, no, you're right. I never even thought about that aspect. If you're shooting it, no, but it, no, I don't think it's not like a regular gun where there's a hammer coming down on the ball. It's being shot out by air.
Right. It's more like a blowgun. Yeah. But I just don't know. Like, there must be some upper limit of how much pressure you can apply to the back of the ball versus, you know, going out into sea level air or whatever.
The question is, how many actually will explode, you know, before you even are able to shoot them? You know, you try and shoot it,
and
then
you have
the misfires inside of the gun itself. You know, the gun, and will that jam up the gun or not? You know?
Yeah. And if it's, you know, covered with that paint, that gooey paint, especially if it's got glitter in it, that must, I guess it helps them sell new paint guns. I know that the hobby itself is not very cheap. Some of those paint guns can cost as much as regular firearms. So it's definitely a wide range of prices for getting into that hobby.
Interesting. How many people do you think get injured a year playing paintball?
Ooh, I'll bet it's got a comma in it.
It actually doesn't. It doesn't.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, that's good. Then it's relatively safe for. I don't know how many people play it.
Right. No. So the statistic that I have here is that every 100,000 participants, there's usually about 45 injuries.
Okay.
So, you know, it's relatively low, and they say most of it is because people are tripping and falling. not necessarily.
Yeah, I would think that there's a lot of collateral damage, not actual getting struck in the face.
Yeah, no, I'm assuming there are people who get eye injuries from from it.
Yeah, but most of the people that I see that do it nowadays, they're wearing like a bike helmet and they've got all kinds of they've got like a chin guard and goggles. Yeah, yeah.
Well, just because
or a full face.
That's because nobody wants to have to pay the insurance for that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Here,
I'm sure
it even says here, I'm sure for safety reasons, most regulated paintball fields strictly enforce a masks on policy and will eject players who consistently disobey.
Yeah, I can see that. Probably signing like a 20-page waiver form before you step on the field too. But that's the world we live in.
That's correct.
So,
back to Hans. The idea that, I mean, for me, it's even more fascinating now that I know that this was only invented 7 years before the movie came out.
He was cutting edge.
Hans already knew and he's able to think so quickly and say, this is what it is. It's because I was on a combat ranch, with paintball. And I love the fact that he says red paint, because I think at the beginning they mostly used red, and then it started changing and they started using other colors. Because the red, I guess, was the idea of being able to, make it seem as if it's blood.
Yeah, you can yell medic and stuff like that. But now it's all the greens and pinks and, just basically rainbow colors of –
Yeah.
You can find out who shot who by handing out which, what team gets gets the credit.
Right. And then so John pulls out the gun and hands it over to Hans butt first, which is the proper way of handing over a gun or a knife or anything like that. My kids always laugh at me that, when we're at the table and I'm passing a knife and I always turn it around and pass it butt first, and they're like, why are you passing it like that? Yeah. And I was like, well, because that's the way you're supposed to hand over a weapon. You're not supposed to, I mean, we're not passing guns around the table, so you don't have to worry about that. But,
Yeah, no. And tools of any, my dad was a boilermaker and welding, all the tools are rather sharp and dangerous. And he taught me from growing up that if somebody hands you a tool, they hand it toward you with the handle. And when you take it, you're supposed to say, thank you, I have it, so that they know you've got it and they can let go.
Oh, interesting.
Because you don't want to hand somebody an axe and think, oh, you've got the axe, because you don't need all those toes anyway.
Right.
But it's tricky. It seems. I don't understand. Like, I'm assuming that Hans knows how to fire a gun, and
Hans or Bill?
I assume that he knows. Both.
Hans, we know, because we've already seen Hans use
Hans.
We've seen him use a handgun twice by shooting both Takagi and Ellis.
Yeah. So we see McLean checks the action. He slides it and makes sure that it's working, and we're assuming that Bill can act naive about things, but Hans would know how to look at a weapon and find out if there's if there's one in the chamber, if he's actually handed him a loaded gun.
Well, what John does here though is when he when he's loading the gun, so he manually closes the hammer. Which is something, on the one hand, you'd say, okay, now you can see that it's loaded, but even when it's not loaded, you can do that.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And, Hans just assumes that he's just being really stupid. Hans has a look of disbelief on his face when he's being offered this gun.
Yeah.
And he's basically saying, he says, probably seems kind of stupid to you about the paintball, but I think he's saying to himself that you're the stupid one here. Because you're going to give me a loaded weapon.
McLean says that all you got to do is pull the trigger, which I would assume that he would have handed it to him at least. Like Hans would know, if not Bill Clay, Hans would know if the safety was on or off. And if he's telling him all you got to do is pull the trigger, then the safety's off. Which I can't imagine that Hans would think that McLean would be dumb enough to hand him a gun with the safety off.
No, but if it's someone who doesn't really know how to use a gun, let's talk in a theoretical world, that that John thinks that, that Bill is going to be able to help him. He doesn't want Bill to be obstructed by the fact that he needs to think about whether he needs to take the safety on or off if he's about to shoot. So from that perspective, it's plausible for him to say, all right, it's already, all you have to do is just pull the trigger. You know, and I love how he goes, time for the real thing, Bill.
Yeah.
All you got to do is pull the trigger. Come on. And at this point, you know, Han starts talking in German.
He stops being Bill Clay. And he goes back to being Han. I do like, there's a nice touch with the cinematography here showing the difference in, you know, as the power structure is changing. He's armed now and he doesn't have to be Bill Clay anymore because he thinks he's got the upper hand. He's behind McClane and he could shoot him anytime he wants. But they show McClane's bare feet, and then they show
the cigarette.
They show something that McClane can't do. Han stomps out the cigarette, and then pulls out the walkie-talkie and starts telling his henchmen to come to the 33rd.
Yeah. Now,
floor.
What's really funny is if you look when he takes the gun, you see that Hans's hand is completely his fingers are spread apart, and like his pinky is really really low. You know, it's a very strange way to be taking a gun, especially for somebody who has experience with it. You know, if it's Bill, I can understand that he's going to take it awkwardly. But Hans, I guess, continues the facade and, you know, still pretends that he knows what he's doing here or that he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah. So we get that sound. I mean, Hans drops his voice by about an octave and just says that, you know, that heavy Alan Rickman voice, put down the gun and give me my detonators. I mean, it's just,
and it's great because we see John in the foreground, in focus, and you got Hans out of focus in the back, but you can still see what he's doing. You can see that he's talking on the CB. You can see that he's got his gun in his hand, and the look on John's face is, I was right. I knew it.
Yeah. And he does that, you know, I'm pretty sure that this is not the only show where Bruce Willis has said, well, because it comes about so naturally. I swear I've heard that on Moonlighting a couple episodes, but it's perfect John McClane as he's you know, sizing things up and realizing that, I mean, it sounds like he's supposed to be surprised, and he's not.
Correct. And Hans, I think, is surprised that he's not surprised. And the way that Jan de Bont does the cinematography here is great because, you know, I mentioned before that first we see John in focus and Hans out of focus, and then they switch it. You know, and then we see,
see
Hans, you know, pointing the gun at him. Again, his pinky actually is in a very strange place also because there's a large gap between his ring finger and his pinky by the way that he's holding the gun.
Yeah.
You know, which is interesting. And, you know, at this point, Hans then lays out his demands. He wants his detonators. Get me my detonators.
And the lighting becomes very extreme at that point with McClane. And he's got it's kind of like he's got the cigarette in his mouth, but it looks like he's gritting it with his teeth. When he starts the well thing, and that beautiful, it's almost like a Batman, that Dutch angle where he's off to the, you know, he's off to the right corner of the screen, and just with the lighting from below, all very sinister looking, and you know the stakes have changed dramatically. That Hans has revealed himself, and we're expecting, now McClane's in real trouble, but. Yeah, well, I don't want to spoil it.
And he does it so nonchalantly. You know, he just like takes a puff of his cigarette.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, we discussed this earlier this week. I wish I could see this movie for the first time again. You know, and then know what my reaction is to this type of scene, to say to myself, okay, what does he know or what doesn't he know? And what is he doing? You know?
Yeah, it's almost like McClane has his own A7 scenario in his head. It's like, oh, well, this is how it's going to play out. And he's going to reveal himself any minute. And he's, you know, known all along. But yeah, just, it really, these constant switcheroos on who's in charge. It's beautiful the way that the script builds itself up into this.
Yeah.
But very enjoyable.
Yeah, there's no question about that. They do that really well. And I mean the way that this whole minute plays out is great, you know, because it starts off that the two of them are having this friendly little conversation about you know, about paintball, and then it ends up that you know, John has proven himself right.
Yeah. but a great, yeah, it, and it's a great, I mean, this kind of like the scene is almost over. I mean, it's got maybe another 30 seconds to a minute here, but this whole open and close of the, we've been through the entire life of Bill Clay. Yes. Now it's from where he appears. And I would, you know, since we've talked about previously on the show, we talked about Bill Clay possibly being
the inside man,
the patsy. Yeah. Or the inside man. And I would love, the more I've thought about it over, you know, since yesterday, the whole idea of having Bill Clay being the next bad guy in the Die Hard universe would have been great. That we find out that he's the one that had all the, you know, like he escaped with what was left of the gang's money besides what was, you know, before they had Nakatomi, they had done some other jobs, and he knew where all the bodies were buried. So he went around picking things up, and then he was the mastermind for another couple of heists with different themes. And just having McClane meet up with the evil genius Bill Clay in a later movie would have been fantastic.
Yeah, but I agree with you. That would have been great. But when I think of Bill Clay as the inside man, I think of him as this you know, sniveling little banker, you know, who really could plan the whole thing. He might be able to plan it, but not implement it. You know, and for him to can't see him as a mastermind. I see him as somebody who you know, was in debt and needed a way to get it. So, you know, he got in touch with a friend who got in touch with a friend who got in touch with a friend that happens to know this master thief named Hans Gruber pretending to be a terrorist. Yeah,
he could have been another Ellis. Basically, I mean, it's you know, another version of Ellis that he was bigger in his mind than he really was. He didn't know he wasn't as smart as Hans was.
Right.
And I mean, the off-screen possibility is that once Hans had all the information, you know, he wound up. Yeah. He wound up going down an elevator shaft somewhere.
Bill Clay's in Theo's trunk.
Yeah. it would have been interesting. I mean, there's so many different side paths to take on here, but they did a bunch of other ones. I mean, I'll leave that.
No, you can talk about the fact that they bring in his brother and all that stuff, whatever. But is the idea of bringing in his brother isn't really there to try to defend his own brother's honor. You know, they didn't really like each other.
Yeah,
it was just an excuse.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of. I mean, they had to make a Die Hard 2 simply because you don't leave money on the table like that. So, in many ways, I don't like sequels simply because I think it waters down the brand. And it, usually the sequel is a replay of the original done in a weaker form.
I completely agree with you. There are a few exceptions, but yeah, in general, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, when you watch a movie and it ends and you say to yourself, okay, what happens to the characters now? You know, that's part of the thing. Because we get to see these characters for a set period of time, and then you're you know, sometimes at the end of a movie, you'll have a little scroll saying what happens to the characters. Usually that's on real life stories, sometimes not. Sometimes it's just for the fun of it. You know, they're telling us what it is. But like, for instance, a perfect example is the movie Unlawful Entry. Have you ever seen that with Ray Liotta and Kurt Russell?
No. I know it's
okay, very good. It's a great thriller. It's about a cop who's stalking a newlywed couple. Okay. Or a couple. I don't know. I don't remember how long they were married. It doesn't really matter. The bottom line is everything happens. You know, in the end, the good guys win, as in all these type of movies, and they're sitting on the porch, and you hear police coming in the distance. And I say to myself, okay, how are they going to explain to the police what happened here? You know, that's the scene I want to see. You know, the cop shows up and they say, yeah, one of your guys was stalking me and my wife and tried to kill me, so instead I killed him first. Sorry to give away that sorry to spoil that. But, you know, how do you get away with that? Like, how do you explain that type of thing? Which is why they stopped the movie before that, because there is no way of explaining it, you know, in a plausible way. But when you're watching a movie and you're getting into the characters and into the story, you say to yourself, okay, I want to know what's going to happen next. You know?
Yeah, and then what? But it's like, you know, like Gone with the Wind. Do you really care what happens to Scarlett?
Frankly, I mean, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, do you really want to follow the further adventures of Rick and Louie after you know, the end of Casablanca?
Maybe you do. Maybe something fun could happen to them along the way. You know.
Yeah. It's peculiar just to think about, you know, what could go. And, you know, I'm sure there are people. There was even a television series, I think, in 1983, where David Soul took over the role of Humphrey Bogart, and they basically set it in Rick's Cafe American, but they kind of ignored it's as if Ilsa never showed up. Okay. And they kind of went on with this. It's kind of a prequel, I guess, the story before what happened with getting in. And you know, they just try to turn it into a regular weekly drama. But the problem is that you all those in a movie, the character has to grow from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie. So if you stick them in a drama where they have to keep coming back, like Columbo or things like that, even though it's very good, you can't let them grow. You can't let them change.
Like The Simpsons.
And but yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, they did kill off Ned's wife, so I got to say there is some changes on there, but not many. But yeah, it's a difficulty in that you do have to grow in the first movie, but getting into the second movie, then you have to explain that the people you couldn't get back, and the, you know, it's like, oh, you know, Bonnie Bedelia, you know, she doesn't come back for the third movie, so she's either dead or divorced, or, you know, everything that they had told you about how their love was renewed, that was a lie, so it goes out the window. And it's rough. Anyway, they're going to make movies anyway.
Yes. And hopefully they're going to make entertaining ones that we can discuss minute by minute.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Wow. Well, this has been a fascinating week of chatting about this movie yet again. I thought I'd never revisit this movie at such a microscopic level again.
There you go. And that's why you have different minutes to talk about. So you're not rehashing everything that you talked about beforehand the last time. So the script has a few minor discrepancies once again. Instead of Hans, or instead of Bill saying, probably seems kind of stupid to you, it says, must sound pretty silly to you. Again, doesn't really make a difference. And McLean actually answers him and says, sounds better than nothing, which, you know, okay. If he's really talking to Bill Clay, that makes a lot of sense. If he's suspecting that this is Hans or someone else, it doesn't make sense for him to say that. So, you know, he's sort of
little tweaks.
And then the final other changes is Hans doesn't speak in German into the radio, and he says in English, Carl, Franco, I'm on 33, come quickly. And then he turns to McLean and says, put down your gun and give me the detonators. And there is no well, well, well. So that could have been a Bruce Willis, you know.
That's his I'll be maybe, back. Yeah.
Maybe. Well, no, we know what his I'll be back is. that goes without saying. Yeah. When you think of John McClane, you think of Bruce Willis. There's only one
phrase. There's only one phrase. Yeah. One thing I know that, you know, when we get to a couple of sequels down the road, when you get to Die Hard with a Vengeance, I was kind of sad that Hans's brother was named Simon, because it would have been great if his name was Franz.
That's right.
Not only because of the Saturday Night Live Hans and Franz, but Franz Gruber was the composer of Silent Night, which is a Christmas carol, which would have tied in another Christmas story on this. So, but, you know, they had their chance and they muffed it. So.
Oh well, blame McTiernan. But it's just, among other things that we can all blame him for.
yeah, 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 he did right by this movie though. I do enjoy this movie. It is rewatchable, and it's even re-reviewable. I can tell you, I can swear to that. Again, thank you so much for having me on for this week. It's been a lot of fun.
But we have one more thing we need to do here. So we have every Friday we have a segment called Weekend Surprise, where I sometimes surprise my guests with a question. Now, Die Hard is one of the most controversial discussions about Die Hard is Die Hard a Christmas movie or not? So what do you think? Would you classify it as a Christmas movie? And make sure that you show your work.
Show my work. Okay. Well, yeah. I could say that it's a Christmas movie because we do watch it every Christmas. Maybe not on Christmas Eve. Maybe not on Christmas Day. But somewhere in that that period between say the 20th and New Year's, we'll watch Die Hard, and I usually like watching it early Christmas Eve. And to me, it's a Christmas movie. In the same sense, there are lots of other movies that are shaped around Christmas. The Nightmare Before Christmas, even though it starts in Halloween, I consider a Christmas film. There's so many elements to this. It's about families getting together in difficult situations. I mean, you've got John and Holly are estranged, and it's about reuniting a family. That's one of the threads running through this movie. So it is a It's a family, despite all the blood, devastation, death, war, and horror that's going on in the background. It is a movie about reconciliation and reunions. So multiple ones. There's a lot of Christmas themes going on in it. There's a lot of things that couldn't happen except for it being Christmas. There's a skeleton crew at Nakatomi Tower. It's abandoned except for the little Christmas party. The very fact that it's set on Christmas Eve. There's all kinds of things going on from the very beginning of the movie. You've got the giant teddy bear sitting next to John McClane, signifying a gift.
Now, do you know where that teddy bear shows up in another movie?
No, I do not.
We talked about it earlier this week.
Well, it wasn't Empire Strikes Back.
No. It's not science fiction.
was it in another McTiernan movie? I don't know if it was.
Yes, it was.
Was it in, Last Action Hero?
No. We didn't talk about that this week. We talked about a different McTiernan movie this week.
Wow.
Dealing with the Cold War?
Hang on. Oh, Hunt for Red October, really? Oh, it's in there.
The Hunt for Red October. It's in the very last scene when we see Alec Baldwin
getting home,
Jack Ryan, on the plane. So next to him on the plane is a bear because his daughter asks him for a baby brother.
Ah, okay.
So the same bear is used.
Ah, okay. So it's McTiernan's lucky bear. I have to tell you a story about.
He should have continued to use it. It might have
stopped him. Who knows? I mean, Last Action Hero could have used anything for getting a little bit luckier at the box office. I got to tell you, the first place I ever saw Hunt for Red October, and I only saw the first maybe 15 minutes of it. If you remember the opening of it, it's Alec Baldwin is in a plane, and he has terrible fear of flying. And he's flying through a storm, and he's getting very nervous about the whole thing. Well, I saw this movie. I was working for British Aircraft Company, and I was flying from JFK in New York to Heathrow. And right about the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, they started the movie. This is before everybody had their own their own screens in front of them. This was the movie that we were all going to watch. And so they were showing the beginning of The Hunt for Red October. And as we're watching the movie, there started being this loud thumping noise in the plane. We're in a 747 over the middle Atlantic Ocean. And so this loud thump, 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 thump is coming from the left-hand side of the plane. So the people that are sitting on the left-hand side of the plane put up their curtains that everything was dark to watch the movie. It's the middle of the day. And out the left-hand side of the plane, there was a big chunk of the left wing was blowing up in the air and flapping. And every time it flapped, the plane went left, and all of a sudden, a big hunk of the skin of the left wing, what they call delaminated, it peeled off and blew away and hit the vertical stabilizer behind us. We're at 30,000 feet. The plane makes a sudden left bank, and we start going down in a spiral. and we're going down from 30,000 feet to 20,000 feet to 10,000 feet, and we are not pulling out of this dive, this spiral turn going down toward the ocean. And at 2,000 feet, he finally pulls up, and we're flying just about over the waves. And the captain came on and said, we've had some problems with the left wing. We're talking to the engineers back at Kennedy, and they're telling us we will not make it to Heathrow. And everybody's like, oh, no. So he said, we will be landing in Shannon. And then he came back on the – and he said, Shannon's in Ireland, by the way. So and he said, and that's 2 hours and 50 minutes in front of us. So the plane is – shuddering along at over the wave tops for almost 3 hours, and we had to make an emergency landing in Shannon with the whole thing where you had to put your hands on the seat in front of you and prepare to crash.
Oh, wow.
But he landed it perfectly.
Very scary.
And, I never got to see the end of Hunt for Red October that time because they turned everything off so they could make all these announcements. But every time I see Hunt for Red October, I get that same thump in my stomach that Alec Baldwin was having at the beginning of the movie. Anyway, that's my only Hunt for Red October story that I have, but it's a pretty good one.
But you've seen the movie since,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've seen it end to end, and I've gotten over my my fear of – I figured how it'll never happen twice, so I feel really good getting on planes nowadays.
That's very good. All right. So, Jim, you want to, for one last time this week, let people know how they can find Jim O'Kane?
Yeah, I'm everywhere pretty much. You just type jimocane.com and you can find all of my works out there. We both belong to a group called Movies by Minutes, and at moviesbyminutes.com you can find many of my shows, but jimocane.com has all the ones that I either produced or hosted or both. So so check that out. We're always available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. If you type in things like the Rocketeer Minute, rocketeer minute.com, or we have
Apollo 13.
Yeah, Apollo 13. We did Die Hard Minutes. You can go to dieHardMinute.com. If you want to hear the alternate version of this particular minute, you can go out and hear those. JimOcane.com is probably the best place to track my stuff down.
You see, it's always nice to have an alternate world.
Yeah.
We're the
Coke and Pepsi.
We're in the multiverse.
Yeah.
This is the multiverse.
Yeah, that's right.
The multiverse of Die Hard.
You know, somebody's going to do this again, which, they remake movies all the time. We might as well make remake movie reviews all the time, get a different take, get a different view. So I'm all in.
Yeah, but you see, as I mentioned earlier this week, I'm not a fan of remaking movies because usually the remake is bad.
Yeah.
So I don't want that to be thought of.
No.
I don't want this show to be thought of that way.
No, it's different. It's different. It's definitely, some people put ketchup on their hot dogs, some people put mustard, and it's all a matter of taste, and it's good to try. We're like a buffet at Movies by Minutes, so you can come back and try different brands.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So, once again, Jim, thank you very much. This was a great week. I had a lot of fun.
Me too.
Hopefully you did too. Hopefully everyone listening is also enjoying our conversations. And I'll be back on Monday with another guest. So until Monday, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.